Welcome to NPR's Movie Podcast. This week, a conversation about the uptick in movie ticket sales as a reflection of the troubled economy. A review of Pinocchio, both the new Disney DVD and a reprint of the book it was based on. And first up, NPR's Kenny Turan reviews The Watchmen.
Independent and funded in part by their listeners. Please give to your station today.
If you're a fan of movies about comic book superheroes, you've probably been looking forward to this weekend. Watchmen is finally making it to the big screen. Los Angeles Times and Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan wonders if it's been worth the wait.
Watchmen was a landmark as a graphic novel, but as a film, it's only pedestrian. It's not a question of fidelity. The film has been quite faithful to the graphic novel story about a nefarious plot to eliminate costumed superheroes from an alternate reality America they've protected and defended.
Congress is pushing through some new bill that's going to outlaw masks. Our days are numbered. Till then, it's like you always say, we're society's only protection.
From what?
Are you kidding me? From themselves.
Some of these superheroes have retired, while others, like the psychotic Rorschach, continue working clandestinely. And then there's the only being in this world with true superpowers, courtesy of your standard scientific experiment gone horribly wrong. He's a government employee now, and they've named him Dr. Manhattan.
They explain the name has been chosen for the ominous associations it will raise in America's enemies. They are shaping me into something gaudy. Something lethal.
After I saw this movie, I went back to the graphic novel. I was struck again that what made Watchmen a sensation was not its plot, but a structural denseness and complexity, the way it used multiple elements to comment on the core story in an almost Talmudic way. That essence is close to impossible to recreate on the screen, even with a 2-hour and 41-minute running time. It may seem like a no-brainer to turn a graphic novel into a film. Hey, they're both visual media, right? But this turns out not to be the case. A narrative with the texture and complexity of Watchmen demands to be on the page, demands to be read again and again before all its secrets are revealed. And film simply doesn't have the time for that. What went wrong with Watchmen is not really anyone's fault. It never should have been turned into a film in the first place. But when the studios think they can make hundreds of millions of dollars out of fanboys, that is not going to happen. Maybe in an alternate reality, but not in ours.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times, and we review more movies, including a Russian remake of 12 Angry Men called 12 at NPR.org.
In this stretch of nearly constant, awful economic news, no surprise that people are looking for an escape. For many, one of the cheapest ways to get away from it all is at the movies. Ticket sales have been up over the past few months. To talk more about that, we're joined now by Pamela McClintock of Variety. And Pamela, compared to past years, just how much have ticket sales increased?
Well, so far this year, revenues are up more than 10%, and the more startling gain is in admissions, the actual number of people going to the movies, and that's up over 10% year-to-date, which is very unheard of in this day and age.
Why is it unheard of?
Well, I think since the birth of DVDs, the actual number of people going to the movies has sort of been on the decline. Some years you'll see a slight uptick, but never to this degree. So I think it is proof that, you know, as people give up maybe dining out and more expensive forms of entertainment, they're opting to go to the movies more.
And are certain types of movies faring better than others?
Well, I mean, a wide range of movies have done well, from Taken to Paul Blart Mall Cop. I mean, there is a feeling here that comedies are going to play better. But I'm not convinced that, you know, that's an absolute truth.
So how is the movie industry doing overall?
Well, I mean, all the studios are owned by big conglomerates who have a lot of other interests, including television and other ad revenue-based businesses. And as we all know, ads are down, so they are struggling in other areas. And on the movie side, the DVD market is also hurting, so that drags down the bottom line as well.
And, of course, you also have in recent weeks this never-ending stalemate with the contract negotiations with the Screen Actors Guild. How is that affecting production?
You know, I think most studios are pretty confident that there won't be a strike, but, you know, there is the threat of it. And, you know, I think people are planning on going ahead with productions.
The big film this past weekend was Watchmen, which made $50 million opening weekend, which is a lot of money, but it was less than expected. Is that an indication at all that maybe business might slow down a bit at the box office?
I don't think you can say that just based on Watchmen, because Watchmen was a particular sort of movie, and, you know, it's 2 hours and 40 minutes, and it's rated R, so right away, you know, it's got some limitations. You know, it's a graphic novel that not everybody knows, so it doesn't have the same broad appeal that a Superman or a Batman or a Spider-Man has.
Going forward, we're heading into spring. Summer's not too far off. If you can look ahead into the future, what do you see coming up for box office sales if the economy continues to proceed as it has been?
You know, if movies continue to strike a chord like they have been, I think it's going to be a big summer. You certainly have some huge titles, Terminator and one of the Harry Potter movies and Paramount Star Trek, among, you know, other movies. And there are a lot of comedies, so I think the question on that side is, you know, is there room for two or three comedies in the marketplace?
Pamela McClintock covers the movie business for Variety. Thanks.
Thank you.
Pinocchio, the story of a puppet who becomes a real boy, is one of the world's best-known children's stories. There are many different versions of the tale, from Carlo Collodi's original book, which has just been released in a new translation by the New York Review of Books, to Walt Disney's famous animated film, which is being released in a 70th anniversary DVD and Blu-ray package on March 10th. Our critic-at-large John Powers, who was raised on the movie, finally read the book a few days ago and discovered that there are very different ways of pulling the puppet boy's strings.
Near the end of E.L. Doctorow's novel, The Book of Daniel, its alienated young hero goes to Disneyland. Walking through the park, he points out that much of Disney's work is derived from dark, subversive writers like Lewis Carroll, Mark Twain, and the Brothers Grimm, but that his movies and rides erase all the darkness and subversion. Disney turns their stories into sentimental lies. I thought about this when I picked up Jeffrey Brock's brisk new translation of Carlo Collodi's Pinocchio. Although the story of the puppet boy is part of our modern mythology, like Peter Pan or The Wizard of Oz, I soon realized that I didn't have a clue what was in the 1881 original. Everything I knew about Pinocchio had come from the 1939 Disney cartoon that I saw as a kid and still love today. Now, the rudiments of Collodi's tale are similar to what most of us remember from the movie. Pinocchio is a puppet, fashioned in the workshop of the craftsman Geppetto, who has adventures that turn him into a real boy. Along the way, he gets suckered by a scheming fox and cat, goes to a seductive toyland where boys are turned into donkeys, and gets swallowed by an enormous fish. When Pinocchio lies, his nose grows. Yet for all these familiar things, Collodi's book is from the beginning a very different and much wilder experience. Geppetto isn't a kindly old man. He's hot-tempered and grindingly poor. There is a talking cricket, but it's not named Jiminy, doesn't wear a top hat, and by the way, Pinocchio squishes it 12 pages in when the insect tries to give him advice. This lack of sentimentality runs through the book, whose sense of reality reflects the harshness of life in Collodi's Tuscany. This is a place driven by hunger, brutality, greed, and social injustice. Which isn't to say that the book's depressing. In fact, it's filled with wonderful surreal touches, many involving animals, like the huge snail that offers to let Pinocchio into his house and then takes 9 hours to reach the front door. A similar anarchic spirit infuses Pinocchio himself, who's not the cute anodyne figure we remember from the movie. He's a selfish, unruly, sometimes cruel puppet, the very soul of childhood. Which was one reason Disney had so much trouble turning Pinocchio into a movie. People know the story, Uncle Walt said, but they don't like the character. And so his team set about making Pinocchio likable, drawing him less as a wooden puppet than as a jerky little boy, and giving him an intrinsic innocence. He never willingly does bad things. He's led astray, as in this sequence when he's taken in by Honest John the Fox and his dim feline sidekick, Gideon.
I'm going to school.
School.
Ah, yes. Then you haven't heard of the easy road to success. No? I'm speaking, my boy, of the theater. Here's your apple. Bright lights, music, applause, fame.
Fame?
Yes. And with that personality, that profile, that physique, why, he's a natural-born actor. Hey, Kitty?
But I'm going
straight to the top. Why, I can see your name in lights. Lights 6 feet high. What is your name?
Pinocchio.
Pinocchio. P-I-N. We're wasting precious time. Come on to the theater. Hi, diddly dee. An actor's life for me. A high silk hat and a silver cane. A watch of gold with a diamond chain. Hi, diddly day. An actor's life is gay. It's great to be a celebrity. An actor's life for me.
That's a terrific song, by the way. Of course, one could say that Disney himself took the easy road in making Pinocchio. Rather than preserving Collodi's tough-minded picaresque, he deliberately gave the story a reassuring shape, from the cozy seductiveness of Geppetto's workshop to Jiminy Cricket crooning, "When You Wish Upon a Star." And it clearly worked. Disney's wish-fulfilling Pinocchio eclipsed the original far more than did his forgettable versions of Peter Pan, Alice in Wonderland, or Huckleberry Finn. This is partly because it's a far better movie, one of Disney's greatest, and partly because the film actually surpasses the book in two bravura sequences, that nightmarish scene on Pleasure Island, where the boys turn into donkeys, and the scary escape from Monstro the Whale. Yet the big reason Disney's Pinocchio could colonize Collodi's is that for all its wish fulfillment, it hasn't wholly lost the original's primal sense of pain and danger. Money-loving puppet masters, boys sold into slavery, the haunting image of Pinocchio lying face down in the water seemingly dead. All that is in the Disney version, which is one reason why, when it was first released, audiences didn't cotton to it as they now do. The movie was too dark for a country faced with depression and World War II. It's hard to imagine anyone feeling that way today. We're all more accustomed to images of violence and cruelty, although I'm not sure that the last 70 years have made us stop wanting to wish upon a star. We're still more comfortable with Disney than Collodi. Even now, the audience would shriek with outrage if they saw Pinocchio flatten Jiminy Cricket with a wooden mallet.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue.
For more about these and other movies, visit our website, npr.org/movies.